Hello and welcome to Maths on the Move, the podcast from plus.maths.org. I'm Mariana Freiberger.
And I'm Rachel Thomas. Marianne, you and I write about mathematics, but people are often quite surprised how often we actually end up writing about creativity and in particular writing about art. I mean, I've covered art writing about historical painting and perspectives in painting. We've covered it in terms of the application of symmetry or breaking of symmetry in art. And now you've been talking to some people about mathematics and art specifically.
Yeah, and I mean, like you say, it's a topic that people inside, certainly inside of mathematics, often talk about the commonalities between art and mathematics, though maybe to some people outside mathematics it comes as a bit of a surprise. But anyway, the Isaac Newton Institute next door to the Center for Mathematical Sciences where we work, they hosted a workshop recently called Space, Scale and Scaling in Art. Now that workshop came about because back in 2017 there was already a research program at the Newton Institute which was called Growth, Form and Self-Organization, and that was actually put on for the 100th anniversary of a very famous book by a mathematical biologist, Darcy Thompson. And the book was called On Growth and Form. Discussions started at that research program back in 2017, led to a project funded by the National Science Foundation on the intersection of art and science.
And Marianne, you went along to the Space, Scale and Scaling in Art conference a couple of weeks ago. How was it?
It was pretty amazing. So it was a week-long thing minus the Easter bank holiday, the Monday. There were talks by artists, by architects, by musicians. There were talks on origami. There were talks on fractals, all sorts of things. Sadly, I wasn't able to go to everything, but the things I saw were just so interesting. So after it finished, I went to speak to two of the organizers, Andrei Hosinski and Paul Glendinning. I started off by asking them why they wanted to bring together these two communities, the art and the maths or science community, and why it was interesting to look at the intersection of mathematics and science and art.
It's interesting because, number one, because these two communities seem so separate, and they are culturally very separate. There have been some dialogues between individual people, but often between scientists and art historians, fewer directly with artists. And they're interesting because there is a possibility of creating a ferment and interesting questions and posing interesting problems that come from a dialogue across these boundaries.
They are separate communities, but when artists and mathematicians get together, there is an element of the creativity of the two disciplines which is common.
Yes.
So it has, I mean, my experience has always been down the pub after seeing an opening of an exhibition, conversations turn to creativity. You get ideas. How do you use ideas? How do you know an idea is finished? Those sorts of things are actually really quite similar in the two worlds. So there is a sense in which the creative part of what we do has a commonality. And I think one of the really interesting things, and I think Andres has done this really amazingly well, of bringing together some of the practitioners with mathematicians, showing how the two can work together, if they not doing each other's work, but by, you know, a mathematician explaining their interests and how they work these things through, and maybe show a diagram of the sort of, I don't know, it might be some sort of group structure or, you know, network or so on, of moving through things. And then an art practitioner might say, well, that's exactly the sort of thing of structure I need. So I want to produce something abstract, but it has to have an underlying structure. So I could use your structure to help me to compose or to produce painting, using this as my framework.
So you're saying that we can learn from each other about how to understand
both ways is important.
Yeah, both ways. Both and ways. Not just learn, but liberate some creativity. By the way, a lot of what artists do poses problems, real physical problems, mathematical problems for physicists to solve. They do something that hasn't been studied. There are, for example, some artists that use some elastic membranes that do, you know, that they are poured and then they become viscoelastic. And suddenly you have a whole bunch of physics problems to solve why this happens this way.
Next, I asked about the focus of this particular workshop, which was all about scale.
Here, the focus was on structure. And then there are different aspects. Size is very important to structure, what you can contain in it. Scale is, different things happen in paintings at different scales. But there are paintings where scale is paramount, and there are new details come into view when you, which should be obscured if you're far away, for example, you know, pointillist paintings and so on. But and then scaling is different from scale in that it refers to the interplay of different scales, how different parts of the artwork at different scales come together.
You know. It's also about representation. It's also about using, I mean, we had Elizabeth Wright, who produces these wonderful pieces, which are, for example, a bicycle. But a bicycle at, not at 100%, but 135.
Yep.
And so it's an interest, and these are placed in places that you might see a bicycle. And so on the edges of...
pavement.
But
the railing. Against
the railing outside an art gallery. So it's within, you know that you're in an art gallery, but you don't know that this is a piece of the art gallery. And I think what she's trying to do there is use scaling, so changing the size, as a means of drawing attention to an object. And it's really hard to articulate, but what the effect of whether you shrug and just say, that's a bit strange, or whether you look at it more closely and then you might find that actually it looks just like an ordinary bicycle. It's just a bit wrong. And I think that's what art is sometimes very good at doing, is just sort of discomforting you a little bit and making you look at something freshly.
Yes, I was really fascinated by what you told me about Elizabeth Wright's work about making these ordinary objects slightly less familiar. She gave a talk, didn't she?
Yes, and I loved that talk. It was actually the first talk of the entire workshop on the Tuesday morning, and I'd logged on online, slightly sleepy still and expecting... Not really, I hadn't thought about it, and I'm used to seeing maths talks. So suddenly seeing this artist talking about her and other people's work, it was just very different and very, very interesting. So this thing about showing objects at just slightly the wrong size, as Paul said, it sort of makes you look again, it's a bit unsettling, but it makes you sort of question how you relate to reality and your surroundings. And it so much reminded me of that moment when you're coming into land or sitting on a plane. You know, there's this one moment where things stop looking like toys and they start looking real. And whenever I'm on a plane, I try to pinpoint that moment, and you can't. It's sort of...
You mean as you're like, looking down from up high, everything looks like ants and toy houses, but gradually you get closer and all of a sudden they're real.
Yeah, and it's a sudden thing. It's not that it gets more real and more real. It's like all of a sudden they become real. It's very interesting. And Elizabeth Wright, in her talk, she mentioned things like, she talked about the moment of becoming, or about tipping points and limits. And then That's interesting because that immediately speaks to my mathematical intuition as well, because tipping points and limits is something that mathematics is so good at capturing. And also I thought it was interesting that in Elizabeth Wright's work, it's all about scale and size in relation to its context and the tension with the context if it's slightly wrong. Whereas in mathematics, we very often try to get rid of the context. So when we think about spheres, we say, mathematicians will say the sphere, even though there's lots of different spheres with lots of different sizes, but the main property of a sphere is to a mathematician not characterized by its size or its context. So there's definitely a mathematical resonance there, which I asked Paul and Andre about. So here's Paul again saying how mathematicians can contribute.
And I think Andre's point about, you know, this wasn't the only thing, but we are trying to do things where mathematics can in some sense contribute to the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily an answer, but it's part of talking about these things in, I hope, interesting ways.
Even providing some mathematical tools that are very easily accessible. Today there was a talk about using what we call in physics and mathematics maybe also normalized quantities, dimensionless quantities. So I was very happy that this occurred finally in our meeting, because nobody mentioned it before. And it's absolutely critical. And it tells you that you measure things relatively to each other, and that in some sense you're liberated from in this case from the size. So there are various tools that mathematicians think about and physicists that maybe artists don't. That may prove useful for them to think about their art.
What Paul said earlier really reminded me of that famous quote by G.H. Hardy from their famous book, "A mathematician, like a painter or a poet, is a maker of patterns. If his patterns are more permanent than theirs, it's because they're made with ideas." So that was Hardy's quote. And as in the things we're talking about today, as we're dealing with patterns and forms, both in mathematics and in art, there is definitely a dialogue to be had there.
Yes, definitely. But what's also really interesting is how taking a mathematical or scientific point of view can help us understand why an artwork is so powerful, or why certain choices were made by the artist, perhaps instinctively. So the perception of art was actually a theme of an earlier workshop as part of the NSF-funded project on the intersection of science and art. But at this workshop here at the Newton Institute, Paul Glendinning gave a talk which was so fascinating because some very basic mathematics gave a very interesting insight into works by an abstract expressionist called Agnes Martin. Now, Martin had a very minimalistic style, with works made up of blocks of color or defined by grids, for example. And in particular, Paul talked about a painting called Morning, where from far away all you see is just a grid, but as you look closer, you see the wriggliness of the graphite lines that make up the grid. And I mean, that wriggliness just comes about because the canvas isn't perfectly smooth and flat. So ultimately it's down to the thread count of the canvas. And here's Paul explaining what a little bit of mathematical analysis can do when it comes to understanding how we might perceive this painting.
What we're trying to do very often is to sort of think about some ways is how to describe a picture, an object, a painting. Another way of looking at things is how a human being approaching a picture can appreciate different elements of it. And what I found really interesting with the Agnes Martin, so the picture I was looking at mostly was Morning, but for technical reasons, the close-up was from an untitled number 8 in, from 1974. But that was because that was the only one I could really get a good close-up of. And the principle was the same. So with morning, you have this grid-like, pale background painted with graphite lines on it, which from a distance does look just like graph paper. I mean, you know, and as a mathematician, the first thing I thought, oh, graph paper. And but you get closer, and what you can do mathematically, I mean, you know, it's a GCSE exercise to some extent, is to think about how close, what you can see from where. So how far away do you have to be in order to be able to see the whole painting? So that's a function of the size of the canvas. But then, because of this very, very personal sort of graphite line by the artist moving with the canvas, how close do you have to be for that to be visible? And what you can show, you know, just by a little bit of maths, using basic features of how the eye works and things like that, is there's a little corridor of distance where you can still see the entire painting, but you start to see that there's detail in the line. You don't see it perfectly, but you're aware that the line isn't maybe quite as perfect as you thought it was. And that, for me, it's not deep, but it's a really nice way of seeing why Agnes Martin may have chosen, and she's very particular about this, her 6 foot by 6 foot panels as the size of her painting, because it allows this approach and invites you in to some extent. Although I should say, a very nice comment actually at the end of the talk was, it may be that she just wanted something that would fit through her door.
Yeah. But it is interesting though, I mean, even if, you know, maybe she just wants something that fit through her door, maybe it was an accident, but it's interesting that there is, that the distance you need to stay away from the painting to actually see the whole thing is also the one where you start seeing the detail, and then you can sort of go in and out, and then it's a bit like awake, like you say, the lines come to life, so become awake, so it's like the morning. But also there was a quote you had about somebody saying that the grid is sort of a turning back on nature, but then as you see the little wriggles, that's nature totally coming back, because it's the nature of the canvas that determines the wriggles.
Well, that's for me. I think the detail of that you'd have to ask, you know, art historians, but the feeling, you know, in terms of the effect on someone like me, is that you read about these things a bit, and the grid is seen as this way of abstracting away from representation. So if you've got purely a grid, and that might contain blocks of colour, then it's not of something, because it's just, you know, it's just a grid. And so you're taking it away from a representational, natural thing. And for the expressionist, that was where the space for feeling, expression, sentiment, and so on could occur. But you still have to think, well, can that occur with, I mean, you know, I don't know, Mondrian or someone is very perfect. You know, but I've not seen his things really close up. I don't know how perfect they are.
They're not absolutely perfect.
Yeah. I think that's really a difficulty of the representation of modern art that we get on posters and things like that. Because you lose that sense of being able to move in and out. I mean, I'm sure there are superb reproductions around, but I think most of the reproductions that we see, very often reduced in size, you lose so much of that detail and of the motion that the viewer is asked to do. The work that the... So that there is this thing of the viewer needing to do work in order to appreciate art. And I think this is one of those cases that for the expressionists, it's really, really important in a sense that you don't just go past it, you go into it.
Marianne, I know you also talked to the organisers about another abstract expressionist, Jackson Pollock, who's famous for these sort of drip paintings. These were made by, he would suspend paint in a container, and by moving around in a random fashion, he'd pull up drip layers of colour onto these large horizontal canvases. And the resulting images are so striking, they're really complex and dense, and perhaps, I suppose, because of the way they're made, really reminiscent of sort of natural patterns, like the way snow lies on the ground or the way the forest looks viewed from above. But interestingly, they also look a lot like fractals, those mathematical objects that exhibit sort of an infinite amount of detail. You can keep zooming in on these mathematical objects and the detail just keeps appearing and appearing. It never gets less. So at every scale, they're incredibly complicated. And people have actually, we've had in the past on plus.math.org, articles about people using mathematical techniques to understand fractal structures in paintings such as Pollock's, even a way of judging whether or not something is truly a Pollock painting. And how this can actually help us understand why people find them pleasing to look at, as well as perhaps spotting forgeries.
Yes, and Andrzej, one of the organizers I talked to, he's very interested in Jackson Pollock. He's actually a physicist with an interest in fluid dynamics, so clearly he does have an understanding of how paint would behave. And he's also actually pointed out to me that even though many people say that they are drip paintings, they should perhaps be thought of as pouring paintings, because it's more about pouring than dripping, and you can actually see that in the paintings. They're not just drips, they're not drops. Andrew has written a few papers about Jackson Pollock, and there's a nice phrase he used in one of them, which says that Pollock creatively ceded some of the responsibility for the appearance of his work to natural phenomena. Now, one of the natural phenomena is gravity, but as Andrew pointed out, it's actually also very much down to the behavior of fluids, which is where he's an expert in. And he gave me this really interesting example of how a physicist's eye and his understanding of fluids can really help understand how a painting was made.
One can understand a great deal about certain pieces of art by knowing how they're made and by bringing understanding of the physics that's involved. I'll give you one little example, if I may. It's known for some time that in some of Jackson Pollock's work, especially on paper, where the weave of the canvas is less important, we were just talking about this, Paul talked very nicely about this in his talk, where you can see very small wiggly lines, somewhat like what Paul was talking about, but a little different. The oscillations are larger, a few millimeters often, maybe up to about 5 millimeters. This was known to art historians for a long time. But and they were amazed that Pollock jiggled his hand just the perfect way that you have a perfect sinusoidal curve. So any physicist, you know, who spent time thinking about physics in their career will know this is not possible. But furthermore, you know, there was an exhibition in Guggenheim where one of these paintings is actually in private collection, so you couldn't see it. Large on a paper was displayed. It has no name. And you could see these oscillations very clearly, you know, and I looked at it. We were together with my art historian friend. And I said, my God, I know what these wiggles are. And these are the results of so-called coiling effect. And when I say coiling effect, people recoil and say, what is this? Must be something very complicated. No, everybody knows coiling effect. When you pour syrup on your toast, you know that the very thin end oscillates. And if everything is perfect, it will make a little circle. If the background is not so even, it will make some other forms, and it can oscillate also in one plane. So what you're seeing there is a superposition of the motion of the arm with coiling effect. Right? Is it important? Yes, first of all, it fits better with his method of painting, and you understand better that he didn't design in his head that he's going to make this look. It was very odd. that he would do it, but he didn't do it. It was an autonomous effect, a fluid dynamical effect. So, and there are many other examples I could give of this kind of thing. And then, you know, art historians can run with it and think about what the meaning of it is. We can also calculate certain things. For example, you can calculate how quickly his hand was moving across the canvas when he painted this thing.
Now, this is quite an unusual workshop for the Isaac Newton Institute. Normally, the I&I run sort of straight maths or stretching at maths and its applications to other areas of science or society. But this was so fascinating that it had this chance to have this sort of pure artistic creativity on display. And our colleague, Miller Kibble, the deputy director of the I&I, was telling us how lovely it was to hear music coming out of the seminar rooms of this workshop.
Yes, definitely. I mean, having music at the Newton Institute is quite something. And I asked Paul and Andre, how did they go about putting the program together?
The theme defines who you invite. The novel element here in this for me anyway, in this workshop was that we included music. It's in part because I just published a paper on music and I'm working on some other things, which is a new venture for me. But in part also because I know of a number of musicians who use mathematical constructs in composing. And we have actually a rather amazing array of composers who think about mathematics and are their work, their creative impulses are to some degree different for different people, sparked by mathematical thinking. I'm thinking especially about Dmitry Timochkov, who is everything. He is a professor of music at Princeton University, a composer, a performer. He loves classical music, jazz, and so on. So yes, and that fit here because this mathematical thinking underlies the structure. So this workshop brought people from different areas thinking about structure in art.
And I do think, sorry, there's one thing that I think is really important there, is that what we're trying to do at the moment isn't done.
Yeah.
There isn't a template, you know, and I think bringing people in who've not even thought that they might be interested in this sort of thing takes a lot of work. And again, hats off to Andrew, who's made this happen in many ways. And also to people like David Abrahams, who here in Cambridge has facilitated a lot of the sort of interactions and things like that.
So the Newton is, yeah, go on.
No, I'm
a bit so of the geek. Newton Institute is a good, I mean, you know, often when I interview people who've been in programs here or workshops, they always talk about bringing together communities, about, like you were saying as well, about the need for sharing, for agreeing on a shared language. But I mean, then this is maybe the pinnacle of this bringing together of communities.
It's nice to be the pinnacle and not the bottom. Yeah. I was trying to work out which end you were going to choose.
Yeah.
The pinnacle.
It's taking it to the limit. But, you know, we've already tried it, as I said, in 2017 here on a smaller scale. And then people were interested. And I can tell you that when we decide whom to invite, almost invariably the first sentence of the reply, if they have time to reply, some are so busy they don't reply, but is, this is fascinating, I'd love to be involved. Let me see if I can make it. So it's something new, there's no template exactly. Mm-hmm. This is a blessing and a curse. It's a curse a little bit because you're taking some risk. You know, you're putting a lot of effort, you're inviting people. There is certain amount of trust that's involved in accepting an invitation, that something meaningful. People are busy with their lives. And so you're saying to them, I'm going to try to make something meaningful for you, some meaningful experience, intellectual experience. But it's also a blessing because there's so many possibilities, there's so many open avenues it's you know, like a low-lying fruit. It hasn't been done, so you first take...
But there is a problem with that, in that our knowledge is finite and quite subject-specific, and then flukes, what's the right word, where it just chance. So there may be whole lots of people that we're not able to reach out to. And again, that's the problem with the no template, the no community. What we can do is the best that we can do, and not make that the enemy of the possible, the perfect, the enemy of the possible.
Yeah.
But being aware that everything that we're doing is sort of steps almost in the dark, and there might be other torches around. Mm-hmm. It's just we haven't found them yet. And I think that sort of sense of enormous potential.
Yeah.
But, and to some extent that comes with a responsibility, because this is such a new attempt to create community, to create understanding, to create common purpose. It's really quite difficult, because you don't know the right people. You know some people, and there might be wonderful people that we're not getting.
So spreading the word is
so important. Spreading the word, I think, is an important thing.
Yeah.
Spreading the opportunity, and that doesn't. I think it's just very, very difficult to get that balance between, and it comes down to, I think, what Andre was saying about trust, that you need some element of trust to do something that is potentially not quite clear whether it's for everyone, and some people might come away saying, well, I didn't quite get that. But others have been, just so enthusiastic.
So the organisers were talking about music there, and we actually do have some different examples of very mathematically inspired music on plus.maths.org. We've got fractal music by a composer called Dimitri Korman, and a piece of music called Sign Language by our friend Ollie Frieg, and we'll put links to both of those mathematically inspired pieces of music in our show notes. So Mariam, what are the next steps for this broader program on the intersection of art and science funded by the NSF?
So this program here at the Newton Institute was one of the projects sitting within this larger program. And I do know that a further workshop is planned, and I know that it will probably be in the US, and that it will probably be later this year, though the details have not quite been divulged to me yet. But to keep up to date, visit the website of the NSF program, and we'll put a link in the show notes. And we'll also put links to all the other things we've talked about in this episode into the show notes.
That's it for this podcast. I hope you enjoyed this dip into the intersection between maths and art. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye for now.